to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. The most sublime act is to set another before you. William Blake, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to Reading with Joy. We are on chapter 10 of The Great Divorce for our summer book club, and I'm so excited to be back and talking with you all today to discuss this week's chapter and the doting wife. Now, I've been so happy to be back home and enjoying some kind of summery days. Something else that I wanted to tell you all before we get into this week's chapter is that I have been doing my best to plan this fall's episodes ahead of time so that when I get back to the UK, I can have them all lined up and we won't have any weeks missed. And it has been so much fun to dream about what topics I want to do, what people I want to have on. I've also had fun kind of pre-recording some of them. So when my brother Nathan was home, we overlapped for a little bit and we recorded a podcast together. And it's just been really exciting. So we have about 2 weeks left with this podcast series, with the series on The Great Divorce. And once that's done, we'll have a little bit of a break, and then we'll get back started in the fall with a whole series of podcasts. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and release to you all the topics for the upcoming weeks that you can kind of see which ones you're most interested in. And anyway, I'm just really excited about it. And I am excited to have the time just to pour in for this summer to being able to really take time to craft these episodes. So I'm looking forward to getting that to you. And I honestly can't wait for you to hear the episode I did with Nathan, because we had such a blast doing it. And he's so thoughtful and it was so fun. And you all haven't heard from him. So all that to say, get excited for this fall and keep your eyes peeled for the schedule. I'm going to put out which episodes will come out when and all of the guests and all of that. So now let's go ahead and dive into this week's chapter. Now we only have about, let's see, we have 5 chapters left because there's 14 chapters. We're doing 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14. This week we'll be doing 10 and 11. And so let's dive into this week's chapter. Now, to give a little brief overview, this week we see, again, this kind of discussion between a spirit and a ghost. And the ghost is this seemingly kind of, at least according to her own view, perfect wife who spent all of her life pouring into her husband's needs. And it seems like the thing that she's really hung up on, because remember, there's always kind of this sense of something that they have to get over to get into heaven. The thing that she's really hung up on is that she won't have control over her husband in heaven. And this is something that she goes back and forth with, and she keeps on insisting that she's forgiven her husband and that it won't matter in heaven. And the spirit's like, oh, well, if you've forgiven him, then why do you need to have control over him? And it's also kind of unclear as to what it is that she's forgiven her husband for, because as we'll get into in a minute, it's unclear what his failure was, according to her, or if he failed at all. So we see this character, and again, we always want to keep in mind, as we looked at last week, that all of these scenes, at least according to Lewis, via our good friend George MacDonald, are always an example of the choice between either self-choice or choice for joy, which is to say, using our desire and our capacity to love to face outward towards reality and away from ourselves, or to face inward away from reality and to be diminished and to make everything about our own lives and our own choices. So that's kind of what we see here. And so what I think is really taking place with this character is we have kind of an odd thing. Her self-choice is a self-choice in the name of loving someone else. And you'll also see this crop up in the next chapter in kind of different ways, because with this character, she's more obviously selfish, you know. But that's what we're seeing this week, is the self-choice in the name of supposedly loving someone else. And we're going to look at this in 3 different kind of aspects of this character. The first is her nature as an unreliable narrator. The second is the spiritual significance of boundaries. And then finally, how love can lead to redemption if and only if it is a true love that turns outside of itself and towards the wondrous difference of another human being. So those are going to be the 3 things we're going to kind of look at today with this character. So let's go ahead and dive in. Now, one thing that I noticed when I first read this chapter is it's pretty much a monologue. She almost doesn't stop talking the whole time. The spirit interjects a few times, but there's a sense that she has kind of crafted her story. She wants to tell it, and almost the only person we're hearing from is her. And this leaves us with kind of an interesting question. We are told so much about her husband, but we're only told from her perspective. And so that leads us to this question of, what is he actually like? And this leads us to think that perhaps she might be an unreliable narrator. Like I was saying earlier, there's a sense that she has forgiven, she keeps on saying she's forgiven her husband. But what has she forgiven him for? She says that he would have been, very poor his whole life if she hadn't helped him up. I was looking up the salary that he earned in modern day terms. And it would have been around $35,000 a year, which is, it depends on where you are. To some of us, that might seem very little, but to some of us, it might seem like something that you could live on. So there's a sense in which she kind of saw her husband not loving him for who he was, but for who she could make him out to be. So her whole kind of aspect is she feels like he never did enough for her. He never tried more than he could have. And she feels like, I think she's forgiving him for not giving her all that she wanted. And in that way, we have this sense that she is unreliable. And because we don't know, was he lazy? Was he a saint? Was he just average? What was he like? And in many ways, I feel like he's given in to many of her whims. So he has to be someone who's at least kind of obliging. And I think this shows us a important part about what happens when we turn internally, when we use our desire as a self-choice, which is that self-centeredness blinds us. If we can only see our own perspective on things, as this woman can, because she's an unreliable narrator who can only see things through her own perspective, we become blind to what reality might actually be like. If we're certain that our interpretation of the world is correct, we're probably missing out on what reality is actually like because our view of the world is limited. Something that really helped me think about this was when I was in college, we studied this thing called the Johari window. And the idea behind it was kind of what can we know about ourselves and what do we not know about ourselves? And it has these two kind of categories. It's basically saying when we know ourselves, what can we know of ourselves? And there's two different categories. One is known to self, and then the other is not known to self. And then kind of like on a grid, you have known to others and then not known to others. And so they say there's the area of ourselves that is known to both ourselves and to others. And they call this the public, the arena. And then there's the area of ourselves that is known to ourselves but's not known to others. So that's the things that we keep privately in our hearts that nobody knows. And that's called the facade. But then there's the element of ourselves that is known not to ourselves but known to others. That's always kind of the scary bit, right? That there's parts of ourselves that we can't see that others can't see. It's kind of like the fact, have you ever thought about how weird it is that you'll never really know what your face looks like because you're always seeing it in a 2D image. And then finally, there's the bits of yourself that are not known to yourself and that are also not known to others. And that is presumably what only God knows. Now, the reason I bring this up is because I think that what Lewis is showing us is that with this unreliable narrator, with someone who only sees things from her perspective, she has blocked herself off to only knowing what she knows about herself. So she only knows what's known about herself and what's known to others, which is the arena, and what's known about herself but not known to others, the facade, according to Johari. So what she doesn't know is she has no conception, no self-knowledge when it comes to what others know about her, but what she doesn't know about herself. And she also doesn't have any conception that God knows things about her that nobody else or herself would know. So she's actually very limited in self-knowledge, but she just kind of goes around assuming that she has a full picture of reality. And so she's an unreliable narrator. She's someone that we can't really trust to understand reality because she totally trusts only her narrative of herself. And I think thinking through this is really convicting for me because I think it's easy to be sure that the way we see the world, the way we judge people, the way we understand even ourselves is completely true. But by doing that, we can often become blind to real aspects of ourselves, but also real aspects of others, because something else that this reveals in the Johari window is there are aspects of others that we don't understand, and we cannot assume that we have the full kind of picture and just judge them according to that. So that's the first element of her that really stood out to me, is that she's an unreliable narrator because she only believes what she can see about herself and also what she can see about others. Okay, so the second thing that stood out to me is the spiritual significance of boundaries. Now, what I found really interesting about her character is that she sees her husband only in context of herself. So it's just kind of very basically self-centered. But I think that what that boils down to is she sees him as an extension of herself, an extension of her own desires, her frustrations, her needs, and she doesn't see him as another person who's totally separate from him. And that's why I opened up with this quotation from William Blake about to set another before you. And because of this, I would say that she sees, because she is so self-centered, she sees the whole world as her purview, her area of control. And in that, she kind of makes the world rather small. And I think that we'll get to this in a little bit, because McDonald talks about how hell is so small, because when you turn away from reality, from God, from really interacting with others as distinct individuals rather than just as extensions of yourself, the world becomes only what you can imagine it to be. And so it becomes smaller and smaller, and you become diminished. Made me think of this quote by Chesterton. He says, "The poet only asks to get his head into the heavens. It is the logician who seeks to get the heavens into his head. And it is in his head that it splits." So basically what Chesterton's saying, in kind of a different context, is that poets see the world as a mystery, and so they ask only to get their heads into the heaven. Logicians see it as something they can control and define, and in trying to get it into their own heads, their heads explode. And I feel like that's what's happened with this woman, is that she sees the whole world as an extension of herself. So she sees everyone as controllable. So she tries to get the whole universe is contained only in herself. And in that, it's become this very bland and blank and unsatisfying universe. And I think that that actually comes down to this idea of boundaries, of regarding people as someone different than us. And she can't, because she only sees the world. She's literally made herself kind of the queen of the universe. She can't interpret anything outside of herself, and she can't understand why heaven wouldn't bend to her own rules and let her husband be her person in control. And I think that that's really spiritually significant, because she has bent the universe to the point where she only can see it through her view, and it has made it small. And even in just like the things that she wants out of life, you know, it's all these seems kind of petty things. You know, they might, it's important to have friends and to have a good home, but they're really rather petty things. But she can't talk about anything else, even when she's in heaven. And that's shown that she's made her world so small, because she has made everything in the world an extension of herself, which is really quite sad. So what can this say to us in the end? What could be a redemptive quality that we could bring out of this? And I think really what it boils down to is this idea of that love can lead to redemption if we truly turn outside of ourselves. And this is where we get to the idea of boundaries. Now, when I was an RA in college, I had 56 girls on my floor. And before we started doing this job, they gave us training, because it's a really exhausting job to kind of be emotionally and professionally available to 56 girls at any hour of the day, in the place that you live. And one of the main things they trained us in was boundaries. Now, there's a great book by, I think it's Henry Cloud and John Townsend. And basically, the essential idea behind it is, psychologically, boundaries are where you end and I begin. And that's to acknowledge that we are separate, that you are an individual into whose mind I can never totally get, no matter how close I am to you, that you have wishes and desires and actions, that you have a soul, that you are responsible to God in a way that I'm not responsible to God. And boundaries is learning to operate within that healthily and well. And more than anything, just to recognize that that boundary does exist, that I am distinct from you and you're distinct from me. And I think one of the main issues with this character is that she doesn't recognize that. She sees the whole world, and particularly her husband, as a part of her. She doesn't have that boundary. Now, why is that important? It's important because, according to, you know, this whole idea of desire being something that's meant to draw us outside of ourselves, when we see the whole world as being a part of ourselves and people as not separate from us, we begin to turn inwards and we begin to become diminished. And that's why I love this quote from William Blake. And it's important that we get back to William Blake because, as you know, we said, Lewis is in so many ways adopting his view and correcting it. And in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, he says, "The most sublime act is to set another before you." And I think this is what this character is incapable of doing. She cannot set her husband before her and recognize that he is a different person with desires and hopes and wishes that are every bit as legitimate as hers. And in the name of loving him, which we can all see is kind of this obvious, she's obviously not, she's very selfish in her love, she has kind of condemned herself because she's made the world small. She's made it only about her wishes and desires. And so she's not open to the possibility of the vastness of another person. And I think that that's what Blake is saying, is that when you truly recognize the vastness and the complexity and the difference of someone before you, you can't stay tied up in your own selfishness. It draws you outside of yourself towards the other person, but ultimately towards reality and towards God. And it reminds me of this verse in John. It's always struck me when it says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God." I've always thought this is a really striking verse because it's very plain. It just says, if you have loved, you know God. And I think part of what that is saying is that when you truly love someone, when you treat them as more important than you, as someone who has equally important desires and wishes, and someone, when you regard someone as eternally important, you cannot stay with your desires pointed inward. You have to pull yourself out of yourself. You have to become unselfish. And in doing that, we reckon with reality and we reckon with God. And I think that this is the beginning of redemption. If you could simply begin to regard someone as ultimately different from yourself, it breaks that idea that the whole world is a part of you. And it begins to kind of pull yourself out of yourself and towards God, towards reality, and towards redemption. And I think that ultimately, in the end of this chapter, it's rather disturbing, she snaps into nothing. And that's because once she's made everything in the world about herself, she's no longer attached to reality. And she's no longer attached to the possibility for redemption. And that's a pretty scary thing. So I think what this made me think about is how do we love people? And how we can sometimes say that we're loving people when in actuality we're just loving the extensions of ourselves that we've created them to be. And we've made them into kind of these workhorses for our own desires and needs and views of the world. But I think that what it encourages us towards is setting other people before us, seeing them as someone distinct, as worthy, as having desires and wishes that are beyond us. And when we do that, we cannot help but have this outward-facing movement. So that is this chapter, really, to me, is looking at someone who has only able to see people as an extension of themselves and who's not able to sacrifice any of her wishes or desires because she sees other people as simply kind of tools to helping her own desires be accomplished. And in the next chapter, we'll see someone who, on the contrary, sees herself as having sacrificed everything for love. And we'll see the issues with that. But with this week, I would leave you with the encouragement to set another before you. Just sit this week and think about someone you love. Think about what a mystery they are, how ponderous their desires, their internal world that you can't get to. Think about the Johari window, about the parts of them that are known to them but not known to you, or the parts of them that are known only to God. Recognize people as a mystery, that you can't interpret the whole world according just to how you see it, because there really is a reality beyond that. And try to reckon with that, because I think in doing that, when we truly do love someone, we reckon with their reality that's bigger than us, it has to pull us out of our own selfishness and begins to pull us towards the abundant reality of the world and of God. So much love to you all. Thank you for listening to my rambles. Feel free to go and put discussion and questions and what you thought of this week's chapter and what you thought of this week's podcast on either the Facebook page or on the Twitter page, Reading with Joy. I wish you all very well, and I'll see you on later this week for chapter 11.